Welcome to our podcast, Golden Gems, with Dave Shaw and Bill Hansen. We review each week the career and personal life of the great unforgettable artists that we spotlighted on this week's webcast, goldengems.net. So please join us with a trip down memory lane as we take a look at today's artist. Then, if you haven't already, go to the website where we can also look at more of their career and play some of their most unforgettable great hits, which we're unable to share on the podcast. We invite you to join us there also. But for now, sit back and relax as we talk about the life of today's unforgettable artist.
This is Golden Gems. We're featuring today Les Baxter on our podcast. The credit for this podcast must go to Skip Heller, who spent time working for and studying under Baxter and wrote regarding Les Baxter. The following is a synopsis of that very thoughtful and insightful article. Les was born in 1921 in Mexia, Texas, and spent part of his childhood in Detroit, where he attended the local conservatory and was considered something of a prodigy. He appears to have been fluent at an early age on piano and most woodwinds. I have seen a picture of him as a child where he is playing either a soprano saxophone or a metal clarinet. I never heard him speak of his father nor of any brothers or sisters, but apparently his mother was a wonderfully encouraging woman who saw the spark of music in her boy. By the time he was in his teens, he was working in California in various dance bands as a tenor saxophonist and arranger, and also attending Pepperdine University as a music student. Les was very much a product of the big band era. He counted legendary tenor saxophonist Coleman Hawkins as a personal hero. This is typical of any young saxophonist of the period. Hawkins was a huge force on his instrument, and his 1939 Victor recording of Body and Soul was the Rosetta Stone of saxophone up to that time. Les knew and loved that record, and I can still recall him sitting by his swimming pool in November 1994 singing Hawkins' solo.
Les's worship of Hawkins was supplanted by his hearing Ben Webster, Duke Ellington's featured tenor saxophonist of 1939 through 1941. Note for note, he would follow. Webster was a bluesier and had a darker, gauzier tone. He was the Barry White of tenor. Les spoke often and rapturously about seeing the Ellington Band during that period and was influenced deeply by what he heard. Also, he got to know many of the Ellingtonians on a personal friendship level. Giants such as Tricky Sam Nanton, Johnny Hodges, Billy Strayhorn, Jimmy Hamilton, and of course, clarinetist Barney Bigard. Bigard gave notice to Ellington in early 1943 during the band's engagement at Los Angeles Trianon Ballroom. He then formed a sextet with Les, a trumpet player, and a rhythm section of piano, bass, and drums. Les called it the first progressive jazz group. Bigard was an old-line New Orleans clarinetist whose style was rooted in something earlier than the style represented by Benny Goodman or Artie Shaw. What is for sure is that Les and Bigard were absorbed into the band of boogie-woogie pianist Freddie Slack, whose popularity skyrocketed with his finding a large-breasted teenage white girl who sang black. Ella Mae Morris was the featured girl singer, and her Cow Cow Boogie was an important early hit for Capitol Records. The Slack Band features Les, Bigard, Morse, and Aaron T-Bone Walker, the first important electric blues guitarist. Freddie Slack and his orchestra toured widely and recorded prolifically. Probably Les' first prolonged exposure to this sort of professional music life.
He left the Slack band roughly a year or so after joining. He joined a young Mel Torme's Meltones as a bass singer and vocal arranger. The group was by the era standards a modern vocal group, similar in sound to the Modern Airs, who were featured with Glenn Miller. A fellow Meltone was Ginny O'Connell, later Mrs. Henry Mancini. The Meltones recorded with Artie Shaw, the first notable American musician to show an interest in the sort of dark continent program music that would later grow up to be Exotica. Shaw's records, like Dr. Livingstone, I presume, The Chant, and Serenade to a Savage, show him striving towards something less would later perfect. His real break as an arranger came in either late 1947 or early 1948, when Broadway composer Harry Revel called Les to arrange a bunch of Revel's songs that had been written to feature the theremin, an early electronic music instrument, which produced high-pitched, unearthly wail, and was featured heavily in the scores for the films Spellbound and The Lost Weekend, as on those scores, the Revel set was to feature thereminist Dr. Samuel Hoffman. The theremin is not an easy instrument to play in tune, and Les recalled having difficulties getting Hoffman to do just that. The resultant album was called Music Out of the Moon, and it remains a masterpiece of musical futurism. The unlikely instrumentation, drums, bass, guitar, piano, choir, electric organ, and theremin is truly otherworldly, and Les's arrangements are shimmery and gorgeous.
The theremin is, by the way, an instrument with a fascinating history, and a curious reader is urged to rent the documentary film Theremin for a wonderfully in-depth look at the instrument, its virtuoso Clara Rockmore, and its creator, the brilliant Dr. Leon Theremin. And if I can make just a personal interjection, I own a theremin, and I have tried valiantly numerous times to make good sounds on it, ending up with somewhere between a foghorn and an air raid siren. But I would encourage anyone to go take a look at Google theremin and see what's on there. The record is notable on several levels. It's one of the first records Capitol issued in all three of its early formats. 78 RPM album, 45 RPM album, and the 10-inch 33 and a third. It was the first record cover to feature a full-color photograph. It was also an unlikely runaway hit, and of course it launched Les Baxter as a force to be dealt with. The follow-up Revel-Baxter collaboration, Perfume Set to Music, was released on RCA Victor and included the hit Jet. Again, it was marked by unusual instrumentation and a thematic concept tying the songs together, this time musical depictions of different perfumes. Again, it was a smash. Capitol soon after came up with commercially phenomenal, artistically disastrous idea of putting Nat King Cole from behind the piano and putting him in front of a huge string ensemble. Les was called in and arranged and conducted Too Young, as well as conducting Nelson Riddle's arrangement of Mona Lisa. Cole, the genius pianist, was pretty much silenced by the success of these two hit records. Soon after the success with Revel and Cole, Capitol assigned Les to another singer to work with. Her given name is a string of unpronounceable Peruvian syllables. Her stage name was Ima Sumac. Everything about Ima Sumac is subject to speculation, and this is putting it mildly. The one exception to this is her astounding range, easily 5 octaves, probably more. No singer in any style ever showed up with such a range and such an outrageous way of putting it to work. She could imitate the growl of a pre-eruptive volcano, the chirp of an exotic bird, and literally everything in between. her rhythmic playfulness, exotic mystique, and sheer pyrotechnical prowess marked her as a unique talent by any yardstick.
It was up to Les to shape her music together for her debut album, Voice of the Extabay. Most of the compositions in it are attributed to Vivanzo, or Vivanzo Baxter, with one being credited solely to Baxter. Ema denies Les having had any real hands-on involvement with the music in any way. I may have taken this claim a little more seriously had I not stumbled onto an orchestral sketch of Tumpa in Les's own penmanship. The success of literally everything touched by Les Baxter at that point led first to a series of singles that commenced in 1951 with Because of You and would continue with such easy listening hits as Unchained Melody, Wake the Town and Tell the People, Lonely Wine, April in Portugal, Blue Tango, and most notably, the 1956 blockbuster, The Poor People of Paris. Les never really took a whole lot of artistic pride in these records, all of which he arranged, but none of which he composed, although he would always be very quick to point out his success as a hit maker. The most important part of this story at this time, 1951, is that Capitol gave Les the go-ahead to make an all-original album. Giving his druthers, Les Baxter would always opt for the exotic, and his inaugural album as composer-arranger is the first real show of firepower we have of him.
It does not tax credibility one iota to say Ritual is the record wherein exotica is crystallized once and for all as a genre with stylistic standards and practices. Certainly, it marks a stylistic jumping point for Les Baxter, who would turn again and again to music that certainly makes its initial statement on this record. Ritual was another hit for Les, and it was the record in which he took the most pride. Until his death, it was the one he spoke of most often. It included the only Baxter composition ever to be a hit, Quiet Village, which went to top five in 1959 when recorded by Martin Denny for Liberty. The 50s were a golden time for Les Baxter. He was indeed Capitol Records' golden boy, a fact he recalled with bitter irony when he couldn't get anybody at the label to return his phone calls in the early 90s. The Eisenhower decade was a prolific one for Les, and this is putting it mildly. When Les was a guest on the Dorsey Brothers television show in 1956, his Poor People of Paris was the number one record that week. The other musical guest that night was Elvis Presley, who was about to start having number one records of his own. Les did not give in to the big beat. Instead, he unleashed albums that probably had most of Middle America daydreaming more strangely than ever before. The James Missionarized Afro-Polynesia of his exotic works, such as Tambu and Sacred Idol, certainly enforced his standing as the principal exoticist in music.
Les also recorded two unjustly neglected classics of thematic mood music, Space Escapade and Jewels of the Sea. The former concerns itself with outer space musical imagery. Its cover has been compared to Ed Wood. Much of its music is actually Les's most gentle, even sentimental side. Especially gorgeous are The City and Earthlight, which reveal the influence of Ellington collaborator Billy Strayhorn. Jules was the last all-original album Les would make for Capitol. It was recorded in 1961 and is in many ways a close spiritual cousin to Music Out of the Moon. In addition to Jules, 1961 saw the release of his Music of the 60s LP. This was an album of Baxter arrangements of standard songs such as I Could Have Danced All Night and Calcutta. Les Baxter's own music of the 60s was mostly soundtrack work. While each of these records has its moments, none is exactly on par with his best capitals. Unfortunately for Les, the soundtrack work was very nearly anonymous. He scored over 100 films for American International Pictures, the most successful B-movie mill of the time. Everything was done quick and dirty. The players who worked on the recording sessions remember recording everything at the speed of light, with mistakes being covered by sound effects in the dubbing. The grind of scoring as many as 10 budget pictures a year took its toll on Les's presence in the record marketplace. The job paid well between the actual paycheck for the assignment and the composer's royalties that were generated every time one of the movies was shown publicly or broadcasted. But the stock of Les Baxter as recording artist went down, and towards the end of the decade, he was recording GNP Crescendo records with ensembles smaller than he was used to. He had lost his touch, but he wasn't the kind of man who liked working with small groups.
As the 70s came in, Les was still in the B-movie treadmill. He also started recording for Al Sharr's 101 Strings imprint, for whom he made his last exotic record, Cumango. Cumango shows us in no uncertain terms just how much firepower Les had in reserve. He made it in an age of Bacharach, Marriott, Alpert, and other Beatles-era instrumental music. The whole jet-set, easy-listening attitude had taken over where Les's capital output had left off, and to those who were still looking, it must have seemed like the music of Les Baxter was banished to the ghetto of records to be sold in supermarkets, which, by the way, is where 101 Strings were stocked. He would never again make an all-original album, although he would continue through the 70s as a composer of music for film. Les Baxter's artistic problems had nothing to do with his skills, which remained formidable to the last. It had more to do with living on the hamster wheel that is life in the low-budget film industry. His tenure at American International unfairly stigmatized him as a B-composer. He was never offered scores for films that did justice to his creativity, neither in their budgets nor their content. The late 80s saw Les Baxter languishing away in Palm Springs, living comfortably and working sporadically at one-shot assignments that did not befit a composer of his stature. Some of his last assignments were a Christmas album for a California Boys Choir and show music for the Ice Follies. Much better artistically, he also composed words and music for a show intended for Broadway, Cinderella in Rio, which contains much fine music.
Most happily, Les Baxter was invited to have his compositions performed by the Los Angeles Composers Guild. This is something that composers are usually charged for, but they made exceptions for two composers, David Raskind and Les Baxter. He took great pride in finally being recognized as a composer, not just as a guy who wrote B-movie scores. He turned in some truly excellent music for their concerts up to October 1994, when he made his last public appearance, conducting the LACG through two compositions, the new, and as of now, still unrecorded, Metamorphosis, and a strings-only transcription of the tambu cut, Havana. The early 90s brought a resurgence of interest in the music of Les Baxter, one of which he was not particularly aware. The post-punk record-collecting public had found their collective way to the thrift stores, making many of their choices based on record cover art. The rediscovery of Exotica was largely to cover design, the way records by Les, Martin Denny, and Corla Pandit looked. 50s easy listening went from being a neglected genre to a subterranean collector's movement, and Les was nothing less than an icon to these consumers. But still more was going on with him as an oblivious center of attention. Les was venerated in Joseph Lanz's History of Mood Music, Elevator Music. Various fanzines wrote about Les, and James Call and Peter Hustis did an expansive, wonderfully in-depth interview for the glossy subculture magazine, Hypno. David Garland devoted another show to Les Baxter, this time with yours truly as the interview subject.
When Les was finally made aware of all this activity, he was delighted. He had been waiting for vindication from an industry that had long since cast him aside. The post-punk collectors had taken him up in a big way, not least of all Dead Kennedys leader Jello Biafra, who praised Les at length in a second RE Search volume of Incredibly Strange Music. It was a very happy time for Les. He began to brag to his Palm Springs friends about his cult status. He was quicker than before to sit at the piano and play Quiet Village or one of his other Capitol classics. Lounge aficionados tracked him down, and for the first time in ages, there was actual fan mail. In the fall of 1995, this correspondent was called upon to help produce a concert of Les Baxter's music to be presented under the baton of Novu Lounge Meister Joey Altruda. The original Baxter scores were used, with me and Altruda working side by side, 50-50 on the orchestrations. On November 16th, an audience of roughly 2,000 people saw a 19-piece ensemble play the music of Les Baxter. In the case of every composition, with the exception of Quiet Village, it was the first time the music had been played to a live audience and not a studio situation. Les Johnson was the featured soloist, reprising his work from the original records. It should have been Les Baxter's finest hour, but his health made it impossible for him to travel, and his senility made it impossible for him to process the information that his music was to be performed in a manner befitting its greatness. I read a statement to the audience on behalf of him, and Joey Altruda conducted a concert of some truly astonishing music, performed by a truly glorious bunch of musicians.
The last 2 months of Les Baxter's life revolved around the indignities of being shuttled between hospitals and critical care facilities. On a sunny California January morning, Les Baxter gave up the ghost, leaving behind him a son, grandson, daughter, loving friends, and cult status. Baxter died in Newport Beach, California, at the age of 73. He was buried at Pacific View Memorial Park in Corona del Mar, California. The good years were good to him. He was a man that loved his work, his daughter, and Blondie, the dog that was his boon companion in the last years of his life. But the industry he helped build did very little for him and for all the great music he made. There is no way his story can be told without some distaste, how an ungrateful business left him to rot like fruit in the sun. But the business and the music are two different things. Les would have been overjoyed to see how much of his work has enjoyed reissue and would have felt vindicated to know that the hip-hop guys were sampling his music onto hit records. He thrived on attention and loved knowing that his music meant something to the people who heard it. And Skip concluded his writing by saying, "You would have liked him very much." Thanks for being with us today. We could have said a lot about the life and career of Les Baxter, but none of it could have been better than the personal insights of his close and longtime friend. Thanks. Thanks for being with us today. We hope you're having as much enjoyment as we are, reliving some of the unforgettable memories from the golden days of radio. To learn more about the career of today's artist and listen to several of their greatest hits, we invite you to go to our website, www.goldengems.net. May we also encourage you to tell your friends about the show. We would love to have them join us in these little trips down memory lane. And as always, we invite your feedback or comments on goldengemsradio@gmail.com. So until next episode, this is Dave and Bill heading back into the archives to dust off some more unforgettable memories to share with you on Golden Gems.